This is Emerson versus Cook.
Cook versus Emerson.
Oh, come on. I thought we decided.
Okay, fine. I'm Natalie Cook.
And I'm Saya Emerson. And thanks for listening to our podcast about films.
Well, let's be honest. It's going to be mostly us laughing and a little bit about films.
We're going to try and keep it together for you, though.
Thanks for listening. So here we are in our second podcast.
We're so glad you've tuned back in to listen to another crazy episode.
This episode is not going to be about a particular film, but a particular actor.
One of my favorite actors of all time, I would say underappreciated greatly.
Yeah.
Nicolas Cage.
Nick Cage, yeah.
The 48-year-old American actor who has starred in over 65 films so far in his career.
Yeah, it's interesting. He has a wide breadth of different types of films, but he lends a sort of Nick Cage-ness to every role that is singular only to him.
And it's also interesting how many of those movies he has been the star of.
Yeah.
You know, he hardly ever has supporting roles because there's something so weird about him that if you're going to cast Nicolas Cage,
yeah,
he better just be front and center doing his thing. And so we're going to read a couple scenes for you from two very, very different movies that kind of represent the poles of his career. We've got, first of all, an action movie, Con Air. One of my favorite Nick Cage movies because it's just absurdly bad.
It's pretty bad. It has just a murderer's row of actors in it, though. Just a really great lineup of actors.
John Malkovich, Steve Buscemi, Ving Rhames.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Who else are we missing?
John Cusack. John Cusack's in it. Chief O'Brien from Star Trek.
Yeah. So we'll get right in. This first scene we're going to read, it's about 3 minutes into Con Air. And the character played by Nicolas Cage is named Cameron Poe.
Mm-hmm.
And
how literary.
Right. Totally. Kind of a femininity to that first name.
Well, you
sensitivity.
Know, I feel like that comes through with the rest of the movie. That sort of sensitive but smoldering stare that he has when he tries to solve all the conflicts.
He's kind of a Zen hero in this movie. And there are a lot of things that happen during this scene because it's a montage of his probably, I think, 7 years in prison.
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
This scene, which is about 2 minutes long, is 7 years in the movie time.
Oh, and it's just spliced with such great, great scenes.
We can tell you about that after we read it, though.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So it opens on the courtroom, and Poe is being sentenced.
Cameron Poe, you've pleaded guilty to manslaughter in the first degree. With your military skills, you are a deadly weapon and not subject to the same laws as other people that are provoked because you can respond with deadly force. It is the order of this court that you be remanded to a federal penitentiary where you shall remain incarcerated for a term no less than 7 to 10 years.
Don't do Con Air!
And at that point, the 1998 era graphic comes on the screen with Con Air. And then, so now Cameron Poe is in his prison cell and he's writing letters with his daughter and his wife. Dearest Trisha, I think of you always. Your smile, your laugh. I'm not angry. The blame's gotta fall on me. I am, however, torn apart when I think that I won't be there to see our child come into the world cradled in your arms and her first smile. I got your package. Those pink coconut things have made me quite popular. I met a guy just the other day, Baby O. He sure does love him. And now our daughter, beautiful Casey. I watch her grow in the pictures you send. I showed him to Baby O. His reaction was simple. He said, thank God she looks like her mama. I'd have to agree. It's funny, but here I am, in maybe the worst place on earth, yet somehow I feel like the luckiest man alive.
Dear Daddy, today was my first day at first grade. I didn't like it. I want to go back tomorrow. I don't want to go back tomorrow. This boy, Scotty Dalton, has black teeth and calls me names. Mama says I have to go back. Tell her not to make me.
Dear Casey, hopefully this finds you still going to the first grade. School is very important. Your mama's right. But don't you worry about little Scotty Dalton. Sometimes you meet people like that, but don't let him get you down.
Dear Daddy, are you ever coming home?
Dear Casey, of course I'm coming home. Just a little while longer, and all the things we miss doing together, you can be sure we'll do. Dear Hummingbird, break out the fine china, chill the lemonade, tie a yellow ribbon round the old oak tree. 'Cause this boy is coming home to his ladies. Coming home forever. I just hope I'm not a disappointment to Casey or to you. Love, Cameron. So during this scene, Nick Cage is in his prison cell, and he is bettering himself.
Yeah, yep.
Natalie, what can you tell us some of the ways that he is bettering himself?
Well, this was I just watched this movie for the first time last week, and I have to say that this prison scene montage really just sets up the entire film for what you're getting prepared for, because it's just rife with ridiculousness.
It's just dumb on a very,
very dumb,
profound level.
Very dumb. He's bettering his mind and his body.
Right.
And so he does a lotus position while just hovering above the ground on his fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
There is a handstand push-up sequence.
Right.
Also,
which must have been a body double.
Oh, well, that's just, yeah.
And a pull-up scene where he's obviously being held around the legs and lifted up, because his muscles aren't really straining at all, and his face is just, like, totally severe and stoic.
And I think, and also this, the books that he chooses to read while in prison, How to Learn Spanish, inexplicably, just wants to learn how to speak Spanish, and a book on origami.
Yeah.
And then as soon as he gets that book, it cuts to him making, like, a swan. Just
And pulling on it so that its wings flap, and somehow,
yeah.
And then the power chords play in the background, and somehow that represents some kind of personal growth.
I forgot about the power chords.
Wow, wow, like that in the background, just hitting you right in the gut.
Yeah, the rock guitar,
it's kind of
solo
a
rock
porn
guitar.
Music,
yeah,
a little bit.
And also, it was reminiscent to me of Top Gun.
Yes.
But, so if you could think of that sort of 80s film of just having.
But this was made in 1998, so it seems. Chronologically strange, a lot of the elements.
It's antiquated
yeah.
by this
yeah,
time, especially.
It is.
And I have to say, just from that point on, it's just a confluence of just bad ideas after that. He's going home. He's the only one that's being set free, but somehow he's on a prison plane full of just the deadliest convicts ever.
Right. So we should also say that he was a U.S. Marshal. No, a U.S. Ranger. A Ranger.
A Ranger, yeah.
And so the movie actually opens. The credits are over sort of this terrible war montage of, explosions and helicopters. And that is what leads us to know that he is an honorable man.
He is an honorable man.
Fighting for his country, serving his country. And he doesn't deserve to go to prison, but he's so honorable throughout the whole film that he makes the wrong choices and always puts himself last in order to save various people throughout the film.
Mm-hmm.
But also, he wants to have his cake and eat it too, because he wants to give his daughter that damn bunny rabbit by the end of the film.
He did get, because the day that he is set free is also his daughter's birthday.
Right.
So I don't know how he got a bunny rabbit in prison. I guess they have a prison, like, commissary.
He was saving up those coconut cakes where
they just
and
have,
selling them
they
for
have,
pennies.
Where they have, what would they have in the prison commissary? Matchbooks, shanks, condoms.
They don't sell shanks.
Bunny rabbits.
Well, there is that part where Baby-O says, are you giving that to your daughter? And he says something like, that ain't no present. A present is toothpaste and a pack of Pall Malls or something like that.
So that's what it says. Toothpaste, Pall Malls, and stuffed rabbits in plastic. That's what they have in the prison store for you to buy. It's a barter system,
yeah,
I feel.
Yeah. So later on in the film, John Malkovich's character, Cyrus the Virus.
Yeah.
John Malkovich really had a great time in this movie.
Oh, you could definitely tell. And, I think he's the only person where you saw, like, a true evil face
mm-hmm.
that wasn't, it was a little frightening.
Yeah, because he's an actually good actor. He's a trained Shakespearean actor.
Yeah.
And somehow he found his way onto the set of Con Air. And actually, he looks pretty good in this movie. He's pretty built and, like, he's in good shape.
He's in good shape for John Malkovich.
Well, yeah, but he actually plays a con quite well.
Yes, I would definitely say that.
He sells it. So he hatches a plan to hijack the plane. And every step of the way, things go his way. They are able to kill the guards, fool everyone involved, because this is, like, right before cell phones and digital technology was everywhere. So, you know, they were able to actually succeed in taking over the plane and turning it into Con Air.
This movie is essentially, it is a lesson in suspending your belief in reality big time.
Absolutely.
You just have to go along for the ride. It was just full of just ridiculous things. And then once you just come to terms with the fact that, like, oh yeah, you know, that does make sense that a prison transpo will carry every single horrible criminal ever in one spot at one time. Once you just be like, yeah, sure, why not? Then you can just really revel in the dialogue and Nicolas Cage's, like I said before, his zen smolder stare to solve all conflicts.
So another thing that happens is that Baby-O has diabetes, and on the plane, he is unable to get his insulin shot because someone steps on all the needles because there's just chaos on this plane. Everyone's just getting murdered and getting their asses kicked. And so Nicolas Cage, not only does he have to keep the female guard from being raped by Danny Trejo's character.
Danny Trejo, that's the other one I'm
going to
think of.
Who is just a great evil.
Very, oh, wonderful.
Oh, he's great. He plays a rapist almost too well. you know? I mean, what if you were at a party with him?
Let's not go down that hypothetical.
Okay, sorry. Anyway, not only does Nick Cage have to protect those people on the plane, but
he also has to protect his toy rabbit from being sodomized by making that up. But who knows? You don't know. Anything happens on this
Anything could
plane.
Happen. It's one of those movies where every time you watch it, you think, maybe something different will happen. Maybe this will be a different movie because there's so many elements to it. You can't remember all of the stupidities that are going to arise.
Yes.
Steve Buscemi's character, we must mention, plays Garland Green is his name in the movie. Can't believe I remember that.
Oh, that's so
and,
painful.
He plays a serial killer slash maybe pedophile, although it seems weird that they would combine those, but they really try and just go for broke with this character. They wheel him onto the plane in a Hannibal Lecter-esque
very Silence of the
chair
Lambs.
And mask.
He's
with
got bags
holes
over his
in
hands.
It.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they use, like, magnets to get him out of the chair. Do you remember that part?
Yeah.
I mean, what? just absurd. And then at one point, Baby-O's character,
who we don't ever know what he has done to get into prison.
We don't. And he says that he's going to be in for a long time. And yet we're like, okay, so what? Is he a murderer? Why is Nick Cage standing up for him?
Yeah.
It's almost like we're not supposed to even think that he's a criminal, but somehow he's in prison, probably just because he's a black man.
That's what I was going to say. I was like, what do you think? Like, maybe he did the same thing that Nick Cage did.
Yeah.
Honorable guy, but he's a black dude.
So he's going to be there for a long time.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, at one point, Baby-O says about Steve Buscemi that he makes the Manson family look like the Partridge Family. One of those lines that you think, wow, in the writer's room for this movie, someone thought of that and everyone said yes.
I think it was like this. What if, man, he says, fucking, makes the Manson family look like
the Partridge. What about the Partridge Family? Yeah, totally.
Yeah, okay.
Who knows who wrote this script, but it is truly bad. I would say, too, he makes up for it in this movie by he's really ripped in this movie. He wears jeans, tight jeans. It's kind of a Chuck Norris outfit that he wears throughout this movie. And a white wife beater tank top. Mm-hmm. And his hair is just, I don't even know what you would call that.
It's bad. That's what you call that. You call it real
it's
bad.
It's long, but he's also got the perpetual Nick Cage weird pattern of hair growth that I don't even know what it is. But he should never have long hair.
I think the only Nick Cage hair I've ever liked was in Raising Arizona, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
It seems as completely his. Maybe also in Wild at Heart, also that Nick
probably
Cage
Valley
hair.
Girl, he probably still had his real hair.
Yeah.
But sometimes he has that weird red hair, like in the next movie we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
if you're a Nick Cage fan, you can watch his movies as straight entertainment pieces, or you can watch them kind of with a grain of salt and kind of as a sort of meta movie watching experience where you're appreciating his career as a whole. And that's what I did while I was watching Vampire's Kiss, the next movie we're going to talk about. If you're a fan of his, he just transcends. He just is operating on another level.
Yeah, whole other plane that you've never seen any human go before. And you just wonder where he taps into this from. Is he an alien? Maybe.
Well, and that's the thing. I think I find myself questioning how much criticism he's giving any of his performances. He seems to accept any role. And in all of his roles, he brings something a little strange to it.
So we're going to do a reading from one of my favorite Nick Cage movies, which is Vampire's Kiss. And I think the first time I saw this was on like a basic cable Saturday night, like late night horror thing, which is the perfect setting for something like this because you're already kind of sleep deprived. And I actually saw this movie. It was a back to back. It was very strange. It was Man with Two Brains, which I love, and Vampire's Kiss.
Oh, that's a good combo, actually.
In this movie, Nick Cage just goes through different levels of psychosis. And the only true constant in this movie is his just withering disregard for his secretary, Alva,
played by Maria Conchita Alonso.
Oh, yeah. You might have remembered her as the babe from Running Man. So this scene is pretty further on into the movie when he has definitely delved deep into his madness. And Alva, the secretary, has called out sick because she just can't handle being in this workplace with him anymore.
He's the most abusive boss in any movie I've ever seen.
Oh, but you know what's so strange about it is it's like you kind of... You like watching this abusive relationship. There's something about
it. It's hilarious.
It's hilarious. Yeah. And it's just also equally just incredibly frightening because he chases her around the office. He chases her into the bathroom. He usually apologizes. And then she's just finally fed up because he's having her try to find this contract that's just in a mountain of files. It's so hard to find because it's years and years old. And so she's just done. She's called out sick. And he's come to her house to collect her and call a truce. So this scene is essentially that cab ride. It's horrible when there are tensions between employer and employee. Sometimes the pressures, you know, they just build up. Wait till you get into a position of authority.
Yeah? Well, I mean, if I ever do.
You will, Alva. You're a very bright girl. That's how I know that today, by God, is the day you're going to find that damned Heatherton contract.
I thought you said that you didn't care if Mr. Heatherton left the agency. I thought you said that everything took time.
That doesn't mean we're going to stop trying to do the best damn job we can. The work's not just going to go away, Alva. It never just goes away. That goddamn contract is somewhere in those goddamn fucking files!
Are you all right, Mr. Lowe?
Shut up, bitch!
You know, what I got from Nicolas Cage from this movie is that he's enjoying playing someone who is going insane. So much so that you don't have really any sympathy for the character because you're seeing how much Nick Cage is enjoying his own performance while he's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you wonder if when the cameras turn away, he just cracks up because he understands how inherently funny his own ability to go insane is.
What I found out from just reading up on this movie is that he had no idea what he was doing while he was doing this. No, even the director, they just had no clue what was going with it. They were just, let's just fucking go with that. You're just going to make a barfing noise? Oh, that then kind of seems appropriate because you're sickened with yourself as this character.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's a great sort of, people look at it in different ways. They look at it as a horror movie, which I think is just completely wrong.
Yeah.
When they look at it a comedy, but I think it's a combination of a very dark comedy and a sort of art house interpretation of a sort of yuppie 80s businessman.
Right. It's as if the Coen brothers directed a version of American Psycho. That is what this movie is kind of like. It has a very Coen brothers-esque feel to me, especially like with
Barton Fink.
John, yes.
Barton Fink.
It reminds me so much of Barton Fink in the tone.
Goodman's Goodman character just going insane, and he's this a sort of a door-to-door salesman or something like that. But you're right. And I think having the American Psycho, the Brett Bret Easton Ellis combo in there as well is also very true.
The focus on his appearance, there's a lot of scenes in Vampire's Kiss of him getting dressed.
And him kind of really just really enjoying looking at himself in the mirror.
And the first clue we have that he's going crazy, do you remember, is that he's not wearing socks.
Yeah.
With his shoes.
Yeah.
He's sitting at his desk and he's got his legs crossed and his secretary, Alva, looks at his bare calves and actually giggles to herself because there's something that she can't take him seriously either in the beginning. I mean, then he becomes legitimately threatening because he chases her into the women's bathroom, which, by the way, do you remember the part when he chases her into the women's bathroom?
The old lady.
The old lady. There's an old lady in the women's bathroom. Nicolas Cage comes barging in. His hair is just a mess. He's chasing after her, screaming her. And the old lady goes, "What the fuck?" And then just walks
what
out.
What the fuck is going on in
it
here?
It was just...
And just shimmies out.
And then she actually walks towards the camera, and you see her face after she said, "What the fuck?" A totally random actress. And you just think she had to just start laughing when she got off the camera. It's just...
Well, this movie was actually... The budget of it was very low for the time. They hired basically their staff to fill in, like, the background characters. And I think that it's also full of just weird background characters. Like when he's going into his building, there's these two mimes that are having kind of a spousal abuse, but it's all in pantomime.
Well, they're dancing, and then they slap each other.
Yeah, and it's just like so strange. But he just kept, the director just decided to keep all of this in.
And who is this director? Do you know?
I cannot remember what his name is.
Because I just think, how has he not done more famous stuff? This movie showed such promise, really.
I think it did, and I think that the fact that at this time, like, this movie, I think, was very early on in Nick Cage's career, and a lot of people haven't seen it, which I find really interesting, because he had just done Moonstruck.
Uh-huh.
And he was very method, and he really, like, in the beginning of the film, when he is having another casual sexual encounter with a woman, a vampire bat comes into his apartment.
Flies through the window.
And Nicolas Cage, the actor, was very insistent on that being a live bat. Really.
It looked really real.
Do you know? Here's an interesting tidbit that I found out. Yeah. They had the same people who did the special effects for Star Wars.
What?
Do that bat. They got the special effects from Star Wars to make this.
That scene is good.
But what's funny is that the bat, when it was in transpo, got broken, and Nicolas Cage was so adamant, he sent out his assistant to Central Park in the middle of the night to try to find the bat.
Wow.
Until the director was like, "Nick, if we get a bat in here, you may get bitten and get rabies and die." Like, that's the only way he could get him off.
Oh, come on. They had rabies vaccines in the 80s.
Yeah, but still, he's just like, what the fuck, you insane person? So I think that just... You know, and just a correlation between Vampire's Kiss to Con Air or even Bad Lieutenant, just these ideas of him being crazy, it is just inherent in Nicolas Cage.
I think what he's done, his career, he's made these sort of non-Hollywood movies. Then he had a long span of about 15 years when he was making really big budget, terrible, terrible Hollywood
awful
movies.
For him to do.
Like National Treasure 1 and 2.
Ooh.
Next.
Oh, next, where you could see 2 seconds into the future. Such a useful gift.
Oh, boy. And he's, you know, as we know, he's still making pieces of shit like Season of the Witch and Drive Angry, which I have not seen yet.
Ooh.
I really want to see it.
Oh.
And because even his bad movies are watchable because of that extra little thing that he brings to it. But Bad Lieutenant, which he made with the director Werner Herzog, which is a remake of the Harvey Keitel film of the same name from the 70s.
I would say, I think the difference between Nick Cage and Harvey Keitel, who I also really love. Is Nick
Cage... The piano?
Yeah.
Can we just take a moment of silence for the piano and how fucking brilliant that movie is? That's on my top 5 list. We'll talk about that later.
But I think there's something about between, like, Nicolas Cage, just as you were saying, is void of taste.
Yeah.
And he will accept any offer, it seems like, given to him. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting because the only other actor I could think that does this, also an odd duck, Christopher Walken.
Right.
Which I think there's a lot of interesting correlations between those two people as just being just weirdos from the get-go.
Yeah.
But I also think, in the case of Christopher Walken and Nick Cage, they really shine in these sort of independent or lower budget or just kind of more avant-garde films where their characters can really shine. And I think Nick Cage, this is the case in The Coen Brothers Raising Arizona, David Lynch's Wild at Heart, which I just recently watched. Yeah. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Bad Lieutenant, which you already mentioned. And I think to some extent the movie Moonstruck, because Moonstruck was just kind of a crazy movie about New Yorkers and those kind of odd characters in it. Was he played a very volatile person that was very passionate. And I think that his weird Nick Cage-ness came out very well in that.
Yeah.
But Wild at Heart, which I just recently watched, I think is a great Nick Cage film because he loves Elvis personally.
Yeah.
And I think he really channels Elvis in this. And
Honey Bunny.
Oh. I don't know, Peanut. Sometimes you just say the strangest fucking things. He's like the only voice of reason in this crazy movie.
He's also pretty sexy in that movie.
Very sexy. Totally smoldering. And another great movie starring another kind of odd bird actor, Willem Dafoe. Willem Dafoe, who I think has an idea of what he wants to be in as well.
And Willem Dafoe has a taste level that is astronomical compared to Nick Cage. But, yeah, and it's interesting, too, that we haven't brought up the role he won an Oscar for, which is
Captain Leaving Crowley's Las Vegas.
Not Captain Crowley's Mandolin. Leaving Las Vegas, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where he plays the alcoholic.
Oh, yeah, which, with Elizabeth Shue. And
yeah, to me, that movie is so inconsequential in his career. And why did he win an Oscar for that movie? Because all these other movies are too weird to be nominated for.
Definitely.
And because if you play someone who is a suffering alcoholic in around Oscar season, you may get nominated.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. And that was kind of the peak of his like Hollywood respectability, which has waned significantly.
Yes.
since he decided to do all these other bad movies. But Bad Lieutenant is, I think, very parallel to Vampire's Kiss in terms of his performance. Nicolas Cage playing a crackhead is basically, if you were to design a movie that would make me personally laugh the hardest, you would get Werner Herzog to direct Nicolas Cage as a crackhead police officer.
I can't remember. I didn't get to finish Bad Lieutenant, unfortunately. Does he not also have an affected accent in this as well? That's kind of a Nick Cage motif as well throughout his movies. And
unidentifiable accents.
And he has it in Vampire's Kiss, which is a sort of, it goes from like English to yuppie. But later on, I found out that he attributed this accent in Vampire's Kiss to his father, who his father, a literary professor, decided to have sort of a quote-unquote continental accent.
Which, who knows what the hell that
indecipherable
means.
I'm assuming.
It's kind of like if you cast Nicolas Cage in a production of, you know, Pride and Prejudice as Mr. Darcy, which would be awesome. Let's do it.
Oh.
Maybe Rochester in Jane Eyre. He could do Rochester.
Oh my God.
Let's get David Lynch to direct a version of Jane Eyre, and let's get David Lynch to be, I mean, Nick Cage to be Rochester, and then he would have the same, ooh, woo, kind of weird, it never goes away accent.
It never just goes away.
What? On the blog, I wrote a little bit about my comparison with Klaus Kinski, which I don't need to go back into here, but one of my absolute favorite actors of all time, and I think Nick Cage has completely paralleled his career.
Yeah.
And
I would say, I would think that, like, from what we read today was Con Air, which is the sort of like the height of his action movie career, which you and I think both agree that is not Nick Cage's strength.
No.
It's more lies in the Wild at Heart, Vampire's Kiss, Batshit Crazy.
Yeah.
So I would say from this, dear listeners, skip the action.
Yeah.
Go straight to Vampire's Kiss.
Wild at Heart, Lieutenant.
I love Moonstruck.
Moonstruck, Raising Arizona. Those are probably his.
And I think it's a good combo because Bad Lieutenant came a little later on, so you can see how he the maturation of him as well.
And you know, he really
also starring Val Kilmer.
Val Kilmer. Oh God, what a dream team. Side note: one of my favorite movies as a child was that Val Kilmer movie about lions.
The Ghost in the Darkness?
Yes!
That's a great movie!
With Michael Douglas?
Yes! And he has like a South African accent or something like that.
I watched that all the time. Whenever we would go to the movie store, me and my dad, I'd be like, can we get that Lion movie, Dad? Can we watch that again? He'd be like, you really? You want to watch that Lion movie? Okay. But no, Val Kilmer, he's also an actor with a really interesting background. Like, he does some great movies, and then he makes all these straight-to-DVD movies, too.
Bullshit movies.
And do you know that he has a... he has a really beautiful treehouse. Did you know that he lives in a treehouse? I'm not making this up. And let's just parallel this to designed by like some really famous architect.
Really?
Yeah, he had this treehouse built for himself. It's like a grand, fancy treehouse somewhere in the Southwest. And Nick Cage has a tomb that has already been built for him in a New Orleans cemetery. It's in the shape of a pyramid.
Oh boy!
And let's remember also that he named his son Kal-El from Superman.
Kal-El?
Kal-El, which is Superman's name from planet Krypton. No? I might be wrong about that. But his son's name, he did name his son that. So,
wow.
It's great to have these little snippets of fact from Nick Cage's life, which only build upon the mythology of... He is just a mythic actor in my mind. I love him.
I think that he is he's not everyone's cup of tea, but I definitely think that if you get those movies who recommend it, you can see him in a whole nother light.
I think we also have to acknowledge something which is specific to us as viewers, Natalie and I.
Yes.
That we have a certain sense of humor that this just fits right into.
Oh yeah,
right
in
the cut. I would
definitely say that's
so
true.
You know, when we're recommending these movies, you have to understand that we have this certain absurdist sense of humor where if we're watching a movie and someone is vomiting, screaming, and going "boo hoo, boo hoo," which is something that he does in Vampire's Kiss, that is the peak of humor.
I think in Vampire's Kiss, it's one of those. Boo-hoo!
And
that's just something how he... this is how he challenges himself. How can I squeeze this ridiculous, like,
what other
Looney
actor?
Tunes
yeah.
sound of boo-hoo into this movie where I try to shoot myself in the head and I don't die, so I say boo-hoo.
He puts a gun in his mouth that is loaded with blanks and fires it twice. And he doesn't realize that they're blanks. And then he comes to the conclusion that he is, in fact,
I'm a vampire!
He's an immortal. And I think the best part of that movie in terms of humor is when he's dragging this stake along the street and going...
This is when he's reached pit bottom, you guys.
And it's like an old-fashioned... There's so many like horror movie things that it seems like he's drawing on. Like, it's like... From the old...
He definitely takes from Max Schreck in his...
Oh,
sort of,
absolutely.
That his one, shoulders hunched
yeah,
up.
The
and
scene
like
where
the,
he's walking
the eyeballs.
Through the club.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a scene he's walking through this club and he's sure he's a vampire and he's looking for his first victim.
And
who
to do this, he bought plastic vampire teeth.
And he had to buy the ones that were only $3.95 because he didn't have $20 in his wallet. So he couldn't get the fiberglass ones that were realistic. So he buys these like ones that you'd get at any joke shop. And he walks around with them sticking out of his mouth. And there's something kind of tragically beautiful about it to me. Because it really is a man who has lost everything. But thank you for listening to our second podcast on Nick Cage.
Alva!
We could clearly go on forever. A, B, C, D, E, F, G! H-I-J-K-L-M-N-O-P! Do you know the alphabet? Because Nick Cage knows his alphabet.
It never just goes away.